Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side, your Sleep Number setting. Enjoy personalized comfort for better sleep night after night. And now, during our President's Day sale, take 50% off our limited edition bed, plus free home delivery with any bed and base. Ends Monday. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQBars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Charlie Robertson, thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to get weird with you. There's so much to talk about. I don't even know where we start. Oh my God.
Well, let me start by correcting myself. I heard in my headphones, it sounded like I said Robertson. It's Robinson. I apologize.
Yeah. No, it sounded good to me. I have, when people Google me in America, my name is very similar to a country music singer. I'm just off. It's Robinson without the N in there. And so sometimes people look for me and they go, all I found was some country guy. I said, well, that's not me.
That is great. Actually, that's great for getting people into your work.
Yeah. I was accidentally red pilling country music fans.
Yeah. I had no idea this country singer questioned things.
Right. That's funny. No, musically untalented. So unfortunately, I always look at everybody who's, you know, musically gifted. It's like magic to me. You know, I don't have that gift, but I certainly do appreciate it when I see it in others.
I've got a Fender Stratocaster behind me, and it's a USA edition, so it was made in the States. It's one of the. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine a couple of days ago. Like, what actually does the US export, other than, you know, propaganda and the CIA and bombs,
terrorism,
and sanctions. but Fender Stratocasters are one of those things, as well as us. I think cars and a few other things. Yeah. We were going to say Apple, but then we found out that Apple's actually made in China.
yeah.
And Tesla.
I've got a great picture of me with Mark Knopfler. Speaking of Fender Stratocaster guitars, he made that thing popular. My guitar hero god had a chance to meet him and take a picture with him.
Oh wow. I have an interesting bit of trivia about him. Although now that I've premised it like that, it's now given away the punchline, but okay. I was going to ask you, do you know what the very first song on MTV was?
Well, the very first song on MTV ever was Video Killed the Radio Star by the Buggles.
No, that was MTV Europe.
Oh, and MTV Europe was the first one on America was his.
Mm. Yeah, it was Dire Straits.
And you money, know, I was
Money for Nothing.
When I was 15, I would no, I must it was earlier than that. I was 13. I was in Australia with my family, and we were catching a flight early, early in the morning. There was nobody in the airport except us and the entire band, Dire Straits. And it was on their Money for Nothing tour. And the only two cassettes I had with me was Billy Joel and Dire Straits. And I was too chicken to go talk to them. I was too chicken to go around and say, hey, would you sign my cassette? And then 20 years later, my buddy was running the Greek Theater in Los Angeles. And he said, you want to go backstage at Mark Knopfler? I was like, yes. And so I saw him there. And I said, I have to come and talk to you because I chickened out when I was a kid, and I didn't want to go through life being having that regret. So if I ever saw you again, I was going to come up and say that. So anyway, I went over and talked to him and wound up in a totally insane, like, parallel universe rock star conversation that accidentally broke out around me, because while I was talking to him about, you know, just running into them in the airport in Australia, Jackson Browne and Bonnie Raitt walked up because they had been performing with him, and they started talking to me and Mark Knopfler, and I just stood there like an idiot. I'm just not going to say anything. And the four of us just kind of stood there and had a conversation, and I walked away feeling like I had had a mild out of body experience after that. And I still have the picture of me with Mark Knopfler too from that night. It's crazy, man. And I called my mom afterwards. I was like, I just had the weirdest thing in the world happen, but I am now officially off the hook cosmically for not, you know, for chickening out when I was a kid. She's like, good for you.
I need to correct myself. You were correct. I was wrong. I had it the wrong way around. The first song on MTV was Video Killed the Radio Star, and Dire Straits was the first one on MTV Europe.
Well, then they dominated MTV America, though, because where I was, you couldn't get away from them. And it was just that perfect time. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And most people don't know that Sting is singing backup on that.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know that.
Yeah.
They're all mates.
I would tell my wife, like,
they're all mates.
Yeah. I love that genre of music was like when I was a kid, you know, at the right time, how sometimes music catches you. Sometimes there's great albums that you're just a little too old for and it goes over your head. But that one at the right time, Dire Straits and anything that was coming out of the UK at that time, like the Smiths or The Cure or Pet Shop Boys, any of that like Euro, like 80s first wave stuff.
Pearl.
Way into it.
Do you remember them?
Love it. Who?
Pearl. P-I-L.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
John Lydon.
Yeah. Oh, he did you ever hear the interview that he did? He did it on a radio show, and he was talking about Savile. Jimmy Savile. He says, I know what Jimmy Savile is. I know what Jimmy Savile does.
I think I know the one.
It was in like it was like 1979, I think, was the interview. So it wasn't like after the fact. It was right when they were in the middle of it all. And he was talking about, I know who Jimmy Savile is. Like, maybe someone should do something really bad to him. You know, things like that. It's like, whoa. Like, I think those guys knew what was going on in that whole scene.
Well, funny you say that, because I think that a number of musicians knew and know. I'll give you an example. I think Michael Jackson knew, and all of us got him wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. You know who set me straight on Michael Jackson? Because I had him wrong as well. But to be fair, I was working off of really bad information. That was all we see here in the States. But Richard Willett, who is David Icke's director, producer, Rich Willett and I have talked. He said, you got Michael Jackson all wrong. Let me explain. And he sent me down a rabbit hole. And Rich Willett is so far down that Michael Jackson rabbit hole, I can't even see his ankles anymore. I mean, he's head first down there, but there's a lot more to it. I 100% agree with you.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my site softer?
Can I make my site firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that, cools up to 8 times faster, and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side, your Sleep Number setting. Enjoy personalized comfort for better sleep night after night. And now, during our President's Day sale, take 50% off our limited edition bed, plus free home delivery with any bed and base. Ends Monday. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
That's a really interesting, it's a really interesting story. I remember when Michael Jackson died. I remember that day very. It was a big, big news day. That was a
well. Now we're gonna ask questions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did he just die?
Exactly.
I mean, he knew. I mean, this is why he sold his shares in Sony.
Called Tommy Mottola the devil.
Yeah. And then those leaked phone calls.
Yeah. Oh.
But then, now Charlie, the segue here, and this is a really, really good segue. How do you then filter, how do you disseminate between the propaganda and the actual information?
It's like learning another language, you know. I don't speak a foreign language. I only speak English. But sometimes when I read the words of these propagandists, it's like you have to kind of decipher the code when they talk about things a certain way. You can get good at it, and you hear an official statement that say the government puts out, and in the past, I would just kind of look for the statement and listen to it and go in my head. And now I try to pick apart the way they deliver the message. As an example, they'll say something like, sources close to the president's thinking said he intends to bomb Iran tomorrow. And you go, sources close to the president's thinking. What does that even mean? That sounds like nonsense. That's so it's like cross that out. And it's like the CIA says, you know, and so you start to recognize things like that. When you're watching television news, you start to notice patterns. You start to notice not even so much the information itself, but how it's delivered. The audio tones, dun dun dun, breaking news, Stormwatch 2026, dun dun dun, you know, it's like designed to really terrify people. And I did some work on this with regard to the media companies that ClimateWorks was financing, and like the weather, like just the local, your television news weather is being the graphics that they use, the map where they show the different colors. Those colors have all changed in the last 20 years. They used to be like green and blue, and that meant like reasonable
like
temperature.
More red now.
Now it's red and pink and bright red and orange. And it's like, oh, are we on fire? It's like, well, no. And then they'll show, you know, then you can pull up images from 20 years ago and show them side by side, and they're the same numbers. It's just with different colors. So you can see that, like, oh, they're trying to create this sense, this narrative that, like, the earth is on fire, the climate is hotter, there, you know, we have to be more mindful of our carbon footprint. Right? So there's like an agenda going on there. So I'll see, and all of that is nonverbal. Right, it's not even so much the story that they're telling you, it's the visual presentation of it. Then there's a good propaganda campaign, and in America, something happened over a decade ago. Something called the Smith-Mundt Modernization Act of 2012, and what that did was it modernized the old Smith-Mundt Act. And that was in 1948. It was right after World War II. And the U.S. said, all right, look, propaganda was really dangerous in World War II. We saw what it did. We know because we did it. We were doing it to Europe and Japan. We were making the Japanese to look like monkeys. And we see how awful that is. And so what we're going to do is we're going to say you cannot use propaganda in America on Americans. We'll still do it to the rest of the world, of course, because we're the American Empire and we hate everybody. We were trying to conquer them. But to ourselves, we're not going to use it. And so that law stayed in effect until 2012 when Obama said, you know what we need to do? We need to legalize propaganda to be used inside America on Americans. And everything changed after that. And so now the nightly news is legally allowed to be propaganda. It is like any good lie, 90% truth, 10% lie, and who knows how much omission. Right. And there's the information that either didn't make it into the story or the story that didn't make it onto the news. And because of this, it does a couple things. First of all, it just overtly propagandizes anybody who's watching it into believing a certain set of ideals. But then it also doesn't talk about stories that it rightly should talk about. And because people don't ever hear these stories, they have the faulty assumption that there's really not a problem out there, right? As an example, this is something in the States, in the medical industry, that people really get. Vaccines are extremely dangerous, and anybody who talks out about vaccines is deemed to be a threat by the media, by the pharmaceutical industry, by the government. And so the media never runs stories that are showing how dangerous vaccines are. They just never do. And so the vast majority of mothers or, you know, people who are getting, you know, going down that path, they're going, well, if vaccines really were a problem, surely I would have heard about it on my nightly news. And since I have never seen a story about it on my nightly news, it's probably not a problem. That's the kind of, it's not even an unreasonable thing to think, you know, you just don't ever see it talked about as being a problem. And so you think, well, maybe it's just a conspiracy. Well, no, it's actively being suppressed and not being allowed to be put on the news to show that side of the story, because the news gets 60% of its ad revenue from the pharmaceutical industry, which is allowed to advertise on TV in the United States and in New Zealand and nowhere else in the world, right? So our media is totally controlled, and that's the problem that we face in trying to come to an agreement on anything here in the States. It's like, we can't even agree on the information. We can't even agree that this is what we're being told is the truth. And now, you know, it's just a confusing time to be paying attention, because you don't know where to go for your news. It used to be the television. Now it's moved online. But now you look at these online, you know, independent, these mainstream alternative media, as David Icke would call them, and you go, oh, yeah, it's online, but it doesn't mean it's any better than what was on TV, right? So you're still having to make these calculations about where to go for news.
I have a rule of thumb, and it's not rock solid, but it is a guide. And that is, I tend to put more faith into those who have more to lose. So in other words, you, for example, have more to lose if you get things wrong, because then I'll just stop listening to you. But Fox or CNN, they can make loads of mistakes and it doesn't affect them. No. They don't have skin in the game.
Yeah, they don't pay sense. A price. Yeah, with their reputation doesn't take a hit collectively. People are so trained to go and seek their information in front of a television. It's very unusual. And you know, the television channels here do the craziest things to try to pretend like they're relevant. If you've ever gone through an airport in a major U.S. city, they don't do it anymore. They stopped doing it a couple years ago. But for like 20 years, the televisions that would be playing as you're waiting to get on your airplane or as you're walking through the terminal somewhere, there'd be TVs on. It would be set to CNN News. And CNN, it wasn't there by accident. It was there because CNN paid the airports to put the television news on the channels, paid them like millions of dollars a year, depending on how big the airports were. And then they counted everybody that went through that airport as a viewer. It's just so dishonest. Just deeply, deeply dishonest. So, like, that's how they're like, viewership is up. It's like, you're counting the airport people that are hostage, that don't have a choice, that aren't even necessarily watching the TV that's up there. They're counting them as people, as viewers, and they're selling advertising based on that. So it's like their whole business model is fraudulent. CNN tried to launch something called CNN Plus in the United States. They spent $250 million to do it. It lasted 3 entire weeks. Then it went off the air. They spent $250 million for 3 weeks, and they just went, nobody wants CNN for free. They certainly aren't looking to pay for it, so we have to like do a write down. But guess that was, I think, like 4 years ago. Guess what CNN is working on right now? A paid service here in the United States. Again, they're working on another
no.
one. They will not learn. They cannot learn. It is, and so I actually look at all of this, as frustrating as it is, as a good sign. I say, yeah. Keep talking. Keep talking, CNN. You keep doing Fox News, MSNBC, Sky News, BBC. You keep talking. You keep lying to your audience. They're waking up to this. Just you guys keep doing it, because that's all we have to do is stand back and say, as you said, I think it's a really brilliant way to look at things. Who's got something to lose? Yeah, if I come out someday and I get something wrong, which I do all the time, and I don't address it, and I don't say, oh, you know what, guys, I believed that at that time, but I later got better information. I got new information that was better than the information I had, and I have evolved on my thought. I think people are fine with that. I think as long as you're straight up with them and you're changing your mind for a reason that's logical and fact-based, not because somebody's paying you, obviously, or not because somebody's threatening you. I mean, of course, that could happen, right? But as long as somebody works it out to you and says, you know what, I think this, this, and that, and you go, I can kind of see where you're going with it. Or you just straight up get something wrong from time to time. You know what, guys, I got that one wrong. Sorry, I didn't meet you. I think that goes a long way with the audience. They don't do that. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. I like Alex Jones, but he's entertainment, and I don't think he has skin in the game. You know, he can get, he does get loads and loads and loads of things wrong, but he's got a pretty big support base, so it doesn't really matter that much.
Yeah, I've found that the guys who felt like they had skin in the game working with Alex have left. Greg Reese, David Knight, Owen Schroyer, those guys have left and taken a chunk of the audience, because I think they kind of thought, well, hey, man, you got to own some of this that you're getting wrong, and you're not doing that. And now it's making me look bad because I Owen Schroyer is a super great guy. Like, I've met him, and he's a good dude. So, I think that sometimes those guys just need to peel off and do their own thing to maintain sort of where they're comfortable with their integrity, you know, and that's not necessarily where Alex is with his, I would say.
This is the weird thing about Alex, is that he gets, I think, a lot of serious stuff right. I think, I mean, if we think back to 9/11, I think he was the first person on any kind of broadcasting network who actually went against the official narrative. I mean, he called out the thing very, very, very quickly, I think even on the same day. And then the Sandy Hook thing, I actually think that he was largely on point. And that $1 billion lawsuit is just theater.
Totally. I agree. Yeah. I mean...
But then...
But then it goes on and on.
But then he says stuff like, they're turning the freaking frogs gay.
Yeah. It's you have to appreciate him for what he's done, for the work that he did. The Sandy Hook thing, I'm in agreement. I've written about it in my first book. Entire chapters on it with just bullet point after bullet point that people have never heard, that if they took a look at that, they would go, oh my god, this is it. Again, and that was coincide to happen right with the Smith Modernization Act 2012, so that was a test run for a bunch of stuff, and Alex got railroaded on that, and I think they threatened him, and I think there's different iterations of Alex. It's like and I personally love the comedy component of Alex, of what it is to be the showman and do it and bang your fists on the table and scream about turning the frogs gay and all of that. Like, the theater of that is fantastic, and I appreciate it. And I can certainly respect his ability to draw in a crowd of viewers who are maybe sort of new to the information, or maybe need it delivered in a way that kind of feels like professional wrestling and in some form or fashion. And they, you know, so whatever he's doing to reach that crowd, I'm appreciative of that. But I think then there's other, I think sometimes people kind of graduate from that onto other things, and they look for, you know, they find a topic that's more interesting out of all the stuff he's talking about, and they find a guy that specializes in that, and they sort of drift off and go fall. So he does a lot of starting people up. And my friend Sam Tripoli with the tinfoil hat, he's the same way. He's like the conspiracy lubricant. You know, he kind of gets you into it by doing it in a funny way with his, you know, as a stand up comedian, and he brings humor into it. And his audience, who I know because I've met them out in public, are just a little bit more like rough around the edges and new to the information, maybe don't have all the full retention. They maybe understand some of it, but they're enthusiastic and they want to know more. And I think there's a little bit, you know, there's a little bit for everybody, wherever you are on your conspiracy journey. You know, everyone's kind of waking up at different stages, and for some people it was 9/11, and some people it was JFK, you know, and for others, maybe a new generation, it's COVID and everything that's come in the aftermath of that, or maybe it's Gaza, and that's waking people up too, and they're going, oh boy, like, wait a second, our government isn't acting in our best interest here, and we're starting to do some things that I don't feel very good about. And so, like, wherever you are in that awakening, there's some content out there that, you know, can grab your attention. And Alex has been that for a long, long time. And so I appreciate him for the work that he's done over the years, for the entertainment that he's brought, and all of that. But I fully understand that he's hit a wall at some point, you know.
And I think he's the only guy out there who in the year 2026 can stand in front of a camera and go, what am I about to tell you? Come closer. Yeah. And the camera goes closer. You could only do that in the 1980s.
It's just great. I mean, I appreciate the showmanship of it all. My friend does this show called Our Big Dumb Mouth, OBDM. And in that, they do that show twice a week. And on the Wednesdays, they do a segment called Alex Jones Clips of the Week. And they've got some fan who listens all week long to every Alex Jones episode and cuts like just the funniest parts and strings them together on like a compilation of the day, and they just run them back to back. And I mean, when you hear it broken down like that, you realize he just has 4 hours where he is saying crazy things and totally disjointed, you know, when they put it together in these run-on non sequiturs. It's extra funny. So yeah, I appreciate Alex for what he is, but I also hope that people will understand that there's others out there that have a more detailed or maybe less biased opinion on some events that aren't really.
I mean, he's very pro-Trump.
Yeah. Yeah. Why?
And
why?
He thinks that Trump is bringing down the deep state.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry, I forgot. he's just getting the deep state, yeah, as he partners with them and does and bombs countries and smithereens and it's so disgusting. I don't know how that's the thing that's frustrating about anybody who's been doing this for a long time. It's like, can't you, even if you liked Donald Trump a whole lot, can't you at least be objective and say there's some, maybe I like what he's doing, but not how he's doing it? Can we at least agree on that? It's like, no, so many people are just, no, it's either he's doing everything right or you, what did you want? Kamala Harris? It's like, God, no, but like, can we at least discuss like the tactics, the image, you know, the way this is shown to the rest of the world? We look like monsters. This is crazy. What are we doing here? So, and I think it's important that, you know, I think something that doesn't get brought up, and I try to do this anytime I'm speaking with people outside of the United States, is just to remind people like, hey, this is the American government that is doing this. It's not Americans. Like, none of us, nobody that I know wants this. This is gross and disgusting empire. I wrote a book with Jeff Berwick called The Controlled Demolition of the American Empire. I mean, we are in favor of the American Empire going away. Yeah, Jeff. We are no cheerleaders here. I'll hold it up for you. We are no cheerleaders for the American Empire in any way, shape, or form. It's disgusting. And I just want to make sure that, you know, I try to do the same thing when I'm talking about the behavior of the state of Israel. I'm also saying, I understand it's not everybody who lives in Israel that feels, you know, the same way as their government, much in the same way that there's not, you know, not everybody in America feels the same way about our bloodthirsty, psychopathic government. No, we're looking at it the same way you're looking at it and going, this is disgusting. What are we doing? Why are we murdering people on behalf of our greatest ally in the Middle East? I mean, we see what's going on. A lot of Americans can see through it, but it's such a gigantic machine controlled by external forces that we just don't have any say in it. They say, oh, you can vote your way out of it. No, we cannot. We cannot do that. We're more helpless than we would like to think. That, unfortunately, that's the reality. And Americans like to think we're very independent and we don't need anybody and we're good. We're about to be not good. And it's, and I don't know if people understand like where things are headed, but, it's a very weird time.
My country is the only one that attempted to hold Israel accountable, as you might know. And although nothing will come of that proceeding, it's nonetheless symbolic. But why is Israel America's quote unquote biggest ally? I don't get it.
Well, they have terrified the government structure. It started in 1963 when they were behind the murder of an American president in broad daylight and pinned it on a guy and got away with it. And nobody ever talked about it. And once you do that, and once you participate in the attacking of on a false flag event, attacking the USS Liberty, and you get away with that, I almost don't blame the control group from Israel that has taken control of the United States, I almost don't blame them for feeling that they're untouchable, because they've been able to pull off some pretty amazing feats and nobody's held them accountable for it. Then you wind up getting into 9/11. You understand what happened with that, and that was a joint venture between a faction of the American government and a faction of the Israeli government in conjunction with the Saudis and Pakistani intelligence. And you go, oh, hang on a second. Wait a second. If they can take down three buildings in lower Manhattan and blame it on...
With two planes.
With two planes. And blame it on a bunch of guys in caves in Afghanistan, we're really screwed. You know, I think for some people, the light bulb went off at that moment and they thought, this is a brazen attack on U.S. soil by a group that has disguised itself as being somebody else. And we are now setting about to reimagine the Middle East because of this. And then you get the memo, the 7 countries in 5 years, and you start to go, America's foreign policy is actually Israel's foreign policy. And when people come to this realization, it's always been very suppressed. In the last several years, it's become undeniable. And what's happened is that with what's going on in Gaza, it's freed people up to talk about their criticisms of the Israeli military. And in doing that, you saw how the Israeli government responded to that: social media attacks, buying TikTok, doing things like that. Even people that were sort of on the fence and not really caring one way or another saw that and they went, this is kind of crazy behavior. Now, if you can't even talk about Israel on TikTok, they'll just ban your account. So you go, oh, okay, so, you know, the lady doth protest too much, methinks. You know, they're just out here talking about how they're certainly not manipulating public opinion and doing all this stuff. And it's having the exact opposite effect. In America, I've never seen it. So I've never seen people feel so comfortable talking about their criticism of the Israeli government as they are right now. It's still not directed at Jewish people or the Jewish religion. Still, as far as I can see, you know, without the exception of some people, of course, but the bulk of it has really been just directed at, they just want the military to stop, and they want the government to tell the military to stop, right? But it's not spreading into, like, now we have a problem with your culture too, right? It hasn't gotten to that point yet. But so that's where we are sort of in the awakening inside the United States, which is something I never thought I would see. And it's happening with the younger generation. The baby boomers don't get it yet. They still fiercely defend Israel and watch Fox News and are Christian Zionists, and they buy the whole story. They'll never figure it out, but they're dying off. And that younger generation that's moving forward is going, we don't like your behavior with Gaza, and we have some questions about some of the other stuff. And then they're finding videos and they're going, yeah, what about 9/11? And it's like, uh-oh.
When did you have your Damascus moment?
In 2003, when the American government was trying to make the case through the media to the American people that we needed to invade Iraq because Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction.
What was that girl's name?
Nariah. Nariah. Yeah, that was the first Gulf War, though. That was the one that happened in
'91.
They took the babies out of the incubator. But again, back to the point of propaganda. They were doing it back then, you know, trying to sell you into a war. But what really did it for me, and by the way, when they were doing that, the first Gulf War, I was a freshman in college. And so I was thinking, am I going to get drafted? Am I going to have to go fight in some? I mean, we didn't have a draft, but are they going to institute a draft? And are we college freshmen who are like, 18 years old. Are we going to we're the first ones to get drafted into this if they do it? Like, are we going to have to fight this? So it was on my radar. I do remember watching that. I do remember that war being the first war that was really televised in January of 1991. And CNN was a part of that. And they were showing, like, you know, Peter Arnett and some other guys. They were in this hotel, and they were seeing anti-aircraft fire and tracers and bombs are going off and sirens, and you're like, holy shit, this is like a real war. And they're under the beds, and they're reporting from under the bed. I mean, it was crazy. And you go, oh, this is an actual war. So in 2003, 9/11 had happened. I lived through that. I watched that, like, on the couch with my roommates. I was in my late 20s and didn't understand what was going on till 2 years later when they started to try and sell the Iraq war. And they talked about weapons of mass destruction. And I thought, well, this just sounds kind of dumb to me. But then they said, you know, well, why? They said, why do we have to get Saddam Hussein? They said, well, you know, 9/11 too. And I went, what? Come on. Now it's 9/11. Like, I was like, that feels like I don't have any other answers. Let's just say 9/11, because then you'll go along with it. So right then I knew they're lying about this. There's no reason to go into Iraq. We don't need to be doing this. And of course we did go in and we killed them. Not me. I didn't, the American Empire, not my idea. I didn't do it. The American Empire went in and killed 1 million Iraqis, and they used depleted uranium that gives multi-generational birth defects, and they just did unspeakable things, and they stole their gold, and they robbed their museums, and they did the shitty things that we are told only other countries do because they're third world savages and we're so much better than everyone else. We wouldn't ever just loot the country as well. Well, we did that, and as a nation, and it was disgusting. And so I watched that, and it was just one of those things. Like, if this is a lie, what else is a lie? You know, if this is a lie and they're using 9/11 as the justification, what else is a lie? And right about that time, you start to get introduced to things like the movie Loose Change. You start hearing about Alex Jones or David Icke, and you start to, you know, you have questions and they have some potential answers here. And so you start to go down that path. And so that's what did it for me in 2003. But that was only like just a small part of the puzzle. It wasn't until 2007, I was on a trip. I was just getting ready to go on a 10-day trip to Thailand to go scuba diving. I was so excited. And my friend said, take this book. And he just handed it. He goes, you will like this book. And I read it while I was on a dive boat. And it was Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. And it changed my entire understanding. He was on my show too. Great. I mean, I've told him this multiple times, like, hey, you know, like, that was the light bulb moment for me. It because in the reason was because I was working in Las Vegas in real estate, and it was the second hottest market in the world, second only to Dubai. And we were given loans to people. We'll give a 30-year loan to a 90-year-old man. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't matter. Like, giving loans to people that were making $10 an hour to buy a house that was $400,000 you could tell it was going to be a catastrophe, right? And I knew things were going to end badly in with the loans, but I had no idea that what John Perkins was talking about of countries borrowing money from the World Bank and the IMF and them loaning money to countries that can't afford it for projects that aren't ever really going to pencil out, like a hydroelectric power plant that they say is going to generate this much revenue, pay itself off in 20 years, but you fall behind in the payments to these predatory global bankers. And they start extracting things from you, like privatize your lumber industry and sell it to our friends, or vote our way in a UN resolution, or let the US put a military base there, some bad deal, right, that some country gets himself into because they fell into a debt trap. And I'm thinking to myself, this is what we're doing to these poor bastards that are buying houses, because I work for a big national builder and we had a mortgage department who would get anybody qualified, you know. I was like, oh, this is bad. Like, they're going to lose their house. Like, they're, you know, and I was told, what do we care? We're not even sitting on the loan. The day after they closed, we're packaging it all up and selling it to Wall Street. And I was like, oh, so diffused responsibility, right? Nobody felt bad about this. And I didn't understand the finance. And then everything collapses. And then I had to learn about money, you know? And so it was like John Perkins' book, you know, the sales pitch for the Iraq war that we shouldn't have had. And then living through that real estate collapse in Las Vegas, in America in general, but Las Vegas in particular, where I was, where everything just crashed. And working in the business and not being able to see the big picture, I just felt so incredibly stupid, you know? And I lost two houses, and I just was like, how do I not ever feel this dumb again? Like, how do I not be the sucker at the card game, you know? And so I was like, I don't think I understand what money is. I don't really think I get it. And that kind of leads you down like Mike Maloney's secrets to money magic or whatever. And you go, oh my God. And then The Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin, who's, you know, who flash forward 10 years later, he's sitting next to me on a flight to Mexico and we're going to speak at an Acapulco. And I'm like, I read your book. It changed my life. You know what I mean? So it's been incremental, you know, it's like the one big lie that kind of woke me up was 9/11, you know, but it didn't happen on 9/11. It took a little bit of time. And then that made me think, if this is a lie, what else is a lie? And after that, you just go.
I think if I were to answer that question, I remember in the late 90s, I read one of David Icke's books. I think it was called Children of the Matrix. And I was kind of into it for a while, a year or two. And then, you know, then I went back to Normieville and 9/11 happened and I thought it was legit. And I think around 2009, I watched a documentary called The Great Global Warming Swindle. And that was when I started wondering about the global warming thing. I think that was my catalyst. And then I got into it and I stumbled across a whole bunch of sort of dissident scientists. And then I realized, wait a minute, this global warming thing is nonsense. And then it took years and years and years before I started thinking about other stuff. And questioning other stuff, maybe even a decade. And I think only around 2018 or 2019, before COVID, did I start thinking about stuff like, did NASA tell the truth? You know, did those guys really play golf up there?
NASA was one for me as well. My mother told me that I was named after Charlie Duke, one of the astronauts from some mission. I was like, I don't know. And I would tell her about it. I said, you know, that whole moon thing is totally fake. She goes, I don't want to know all about that. I was like, I know. I'll let you have your moon story, but I'm going to, you know, everything else I'm going to red pill you on. The moon one was a tough one. It's a tough one for me, you know, because it's...
Well, it is a tough one.
Yeah. It just because even if you just... try to be as objective as possible. You say, well, how come everything else in the world, the technology gets better, 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 easier, easier, easier. And yet with this one, we supposedly went 69 through 72. I was born in 72, so I know how long ago that was. And we just never bothered to go back. We just said, it's fine. That's incompatible with logic. You burn the telemetry tapes. You would never do that. They talked about how they recorded over... I mean, I have in my Octopus of Global Control book that I put out in 2017, I have for the NASA thing, I just, it was easier for me to just put bullet points because there were so many holes in their story. It's just pages of bullet points. And I actually, it because there's so many flaws in it. And I'd love to believe it. It's a great, great story, especially, you know, Americans have this whole thing about like first go to the moon and all
exceptionalism.
That.
Exceptionalism.
Exceptionalism. And it's a great sales pitch. And it and I believe maybe it's a good idea to have things to aspire to, but this idea that we're exceptional storytellers, that is 100% true. We have told a very big story.
Wait. Yeah, hold on. I don't think that's fair. You don't need to kick yourself like that. I mean, I think the US is pretty great in many ways. And I think a lot of the criticism is leveled not at Americans, but at the state and the state infrastructure.
Yeah. The American people, you know, there's a segment of them who understand what's going on and they see through this and they're frustrated and ready to do something but you know, unfortunately there is a much larger segment of the American public who have had their brains turned off recently, and they're just not able to think for themselves, and they're talked about this I had a great quote in my Octopus book from Dr. Russell Blaylock, who's a neurosurgeon. He was talking about why governments exist. It's funny because he works on brains, but he also knows a thing or two about governments. And he was talking about how the vast majority of people are stuck in this malaise. You know, the bulk of the population, they're unable to excel at anything. And the state needs that. They don't discourage that. They need that population because that population needs them. And he says, and then there's a small segment of society of higher IQ that's elevated above, that can see a much bigger picture because of the way that they're able to see that, and they can see what else is everything that's going on. But he said that there's just a large group that they're never going to get it. And they're only going to do what they're told to do, and they're going to be told to do that by the state. And so this, you know, it's like a mutually parasitic relationship. The state remains relevant as long as they take care of these people. These people get handouts, but they're not allowed to really have much of a thought. They just do what they're told because it's contingent upon the handouts. So they're happy to get free stuff. They didn't really have many thoughts anyway. They don't really care if the government controls their thoughts because they weren't doing much thinking. And the government gets an obedient class of people that they can tell what to do, and they'll do it for them. So they all get something out of this situation. But it's very frustrating to be in the small minority that can see what's going on because you want to scream.
I think it was Yuri Bezmenov. I think it was ironically the year 1984, where he did a interview in the States with G. Edward Griffin. And in it, he spoke about how the U.S. was imploding without even a bullet being fired.
Four steps to ideological subversion. Yeah. And,
yes.
and he talks about that. You know, the first stage is demoralization, 5-year campaign, destruction for the next 15 to 20 years. You basically, it takes a generation. He says, give me control of them for a generation, I can change the way they think. Now, the irony is that he's from when that video was recorded with G. Edward Griffin, who's the great author from Creature from Jekyll Island, having those amazing conversations with him. They had enough time to run it twice, and probably have, you know. And I think a case can be made that the American public is demoralized. I mean, they've thrown their hands up and given up on a lot, and it was happening for a long time, but COVID really did it. I mean, it really broke a bunch of people, and there and some people are, and that goes to step three in Yuri's four-step plan for ideological subversion, is that step three, introduce a crisis. It must last 6 weeks. But after that time, he said, I can, quote, shower them with authentic information. It won't change their mind. They've been demoralized. So he talks about how it's permanent for some people. If you introduce that crisis, you break them. Because in his world, you know, coming out of the Soviet Union, that was, you know, what do? We put tanks on every corner? You know, or do we do this nonviolently, just through mind control and drab architecture, brutalist architecture, and, you know, bread lines and things like that? Can we just demoralize the hell out of the population to get them to just give up? Because if we do, then we own them. We can control them, but they're not going to be worth a damn. But they'll do exactly what you want them to do. But they're not going to be great. This is end of empire behavior where we are right now. It's the feels like the end.
The sad thing, though, is, and I can't help it, but this is the reality. Is here. So I'm on the African continent, right? As you know, and we don't really have much to offer. Okay, so we can certainly talk about everything that is useless here, right? We have broken infrastructure, high crime. I mean, it's a complete mess. But even on top of that, when people here talk about Americans, they don't speak about Americans in high regard.
We are a deeply unserious country these days. Yeah. And we see it too. I mean, I see it. I'm not proud of the image of the United States, of the empire and the military and all of that. I'm not proud of the image of the United States socially as just dummies who are just consumers who do that. That image exists for a reason. It's true. You know, there is a lot of that. I wish it wasn't the case. I wish I could say, oh, that's all just the media. Unfortunately, there is a segment of that. It's not everybody. It's not great. Doesn't look good. I'm not proud of that. But I also know that, you know, they're not talking about me. Yeah, I mean, you know, but the average person in the United States is very much captured by the media. They are captured by trends. They get on these weird trends, you know, that you just kind of shake your head. We're very. The problem is, this is the problem, with the general American viewpoint, is we're very arrogant, but misinformed, which is the worst, because we're loud and stupid at the same time, which is like, you go, like, be one. Like, it's okay if you're wrong, because we all get things wrong, but don't be loud about it. You know, like, we're very, it's propaganda. I mean, it's propaganda on us. We are taught that. Oh, I'll give you an example of it happening to me. And it just made me want to scream. I was working in Las Vegas and I was selling a high rise condo building that was going to be built in Las Vegas. And we were going all over the world to talk to people about it. China, Hong Kong, LA, Miami, Chicago, and we're in New York. And I just got done doing a presentation for all these brokers, and we're in the cocktail party afterwards where we're schmoozing. We're trying to make deals with brokerages that can help us sell our units in Las Vegas. And this lady says to me, she was like European and but living in New York, and she says, I need more. And I go, how so? And she goes, I need more. And I go, more what? You know, talking about the building. And she goes, I don't know, I just need more. I go, okay, well, more what? She goes, you know, just more everything. And I go, okay, well, I need to know what that means. She goes, look, I just don't know how else to say this. If it's not happening in New York, it's not happening. And she walked away. And I was like, Oh my God. The arrogance made me want to just like recoil. So like, if that is the perception that America is giving off to the rest of the world, like that is disgusting. Okay. And I had that done to me in New York, and I would, and so I see that as like, boy, I wish the people that I know, the people that I hang out with and interact with in the United States, see what's going on. We're rightly disgusted about it. We understand that we don't have as much control as we think we have. We can talk about it. We can get the message out to people, and we do. But in terms of like, is there a political solution? No. Are we going to be able to reach everybody and convince them that it's all like, no, there's some people that you just, you're not going to get to. So, you know, we see the flaws, you know, we're still smiling and laughing and we're still good and everything's going to be fine. And we're going to make sure that we get our audiences to not, you know, doom and gloom about anything that's going on. Like, be honest, be reasonable about what you see coming, like be prepared, be proactive, but don't be scared and don't act like, you know, I don't subscribe to the Alex Jones scare the hell out of people to get them to do things. I would love for people to be informed about what's going on, and maybe that's scary, but you know, but it, just be informed and, but then say, what can I do to be less susceptible? Like be proactive, start thinking about your bank situation, right? I think everybody should relate to that. Anybody that is worried about that, like have yourself some storable food in the, you know, I don't know, have yourself some gold and silver, like, I don't know, do something to make yourself a little bit more resilient. And in doing that, you go, oh, I feel less fearful. And so I think there's ways to approach this where we can see the wheels coming off, but we don't have to scare everybody about it. You can do it in a way that's like informative, but not overly dramatic and theatrical. Like, we're all going to die. You got to get your storable food today at Infowarsstore.com or something. You're like, I don't really want to do that. I do have a storable food sponsor, and I'll be like, go there and get food. But also just go to the grocery store and get extra food, you know, like do that too. Like, you don't have to, there's solutions here. I think if we come at it with like a solution mindset, all these big problems, they seem less scary because you're doing something about it. And in doing something, you're just in a different mindset and just it's way more positive.
Well, so as a foreigner, I'm aware that the US is, I believe this year, 250 years old. And my hope is that Americans will pull themselves together, because whether the world likes it or not, the US is still a powerhouse. And although countries like China are getting stronger, and that's great because competition is a good thing, it holds other countries accountable, I would hate to see the U.S. implode.
Yeah, it would be a bad sign to the rest of the world. I hope that we have a nation that has a drug problem, not the kind of drugs that most people think. We have a prescription drug problem. Most Americans are very unhealthy physically, and when you're unhealthy physically, it affects your mind. It affects your ability to function properly and to understand what's going on. It's a really dark cycle, and you know, most Americans are on multiple prescription drugs, and that is not a recipe for health. So, you know, I think that we need to be honest about where we have drifted to over the 250 years since America has been a country, and look in the mirror, like, you know, like you do when the new year comes and you go, I might need to make some health decisions. I might need to make some different choices in the new year. I think America's in that boat. We need to make some different choices. We need to stop being the world's policemen in this empire mentality of having 1,000 military bases around the world. And the petrodollar arrangement seems very fragile these days. And I wonder what that will look like in a multipolar world with BRICS, which of course you guys are a part of, and how that works as a balance, and what that is, that just two drunken lunatics at the same party? Or
I think
this,
it's a scam.
An example,
I think it's a scam.
Of, yeah, but it might be just a scam too. You know, two factions of the New World Order plotting to come together at some point. I don't know, but there's a for once there seems to be a bit of a balance on America's aspirations internationally, which is good. Good in that regard. I you know, we would love, we in America would love for the United States to be a priority for once. We're not. Everybody else is where the money goes elsewhere. It goes to Israel, goes to NATO, it goes to subsidizing oil companies, it goes to transgender research in Uganda. I mean, it goes everywhere but where we need it, and we need it. And that's another part of the demoralization, is that people living in America are going, we need help. And the American government is saying, yes, but let me tell you first about Israel. And it's like, God, you know, it's like, it's so it's tough to keep that going. And so, you know, I've never seen America this divided. I don't think that's a good thing. It does set the possibility that, you know, that something unusual could happen here. And the social engineers are trying to talk that into existence. A lot of talk about civil war. We should look at your country to understand, like, what happens when you allow things like that to come into existence, you know.
Hey, hang on. Our country is an example of what not to do. Europe had better be watching very closely, because in 20 years' time, the entire continent of Europe, or Western Europe, is going to look like us.
Yeah, it's been sad to watch that.
But there's still beautiful stuff. Like, we have amazing wildlife.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. My wife has been, I don't know, three or four times over the course of her life to South Africa. To
South Africa?
So far. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Travel oh, right. industry family.
Oh.
So, you know, they're all over. They wind up
have
all
you
over
been?
The place.
Have you been?
I have not been. I've been to the only time I've been on the African continent was Cairo, so you know it's sort of.
Oh, that's not. I mean, that's technically Africa, but it's not really Africa.
Right. It doesn't count in my mind. I always think, it's Middle East.
It's not really Africa. No.
I'd really like to go. I'd really like to go for the nature, for the animal component. I would love to. It's on my list. You know, obviously, I've got that traveling bug though. So I had my mother was a international Pan Am flight attendant out of New York in the 60s, back when it was cool, when you'd go everywhere. And that's actually kind of how I first started to get into, you know, learning about what was going on around the world, was finding the places on the map where my mom had gone and asking her questions about what it was like back then. You know, what was the most beautiful city in the world? Where was the most beautiful place she'd ever been? That didn't take, that was a universal answer. Beirut, most beautiful city I've ever been. That's what she said. Till those bastards bombed it. I was like, whoa, okay, mom.
How can my audience follow you? Macroaggressions, obviously.
Macroaggressions is my podcast. It goes out twice a week. I do an interview on Sundays. I do a monologue on Wednesdays. I think I might have the best intro. If you got a minute and a half, you can listen to my intro. You'll know if you're into my flavor of insanity if you hear that intro. Also, I'm the owner of Active. Oh, good. Fantastic. Yeah, I think people kind of appreciate how chaotic it is. But I also, in the first day of January 2025, I became the new owner of Activist Post. That's an independent news website. It's been around for 15 years. It's part of the Disinformation 200, along with WikiLeaks and Zero Hedge, that was banned and had all their advertising stripped away. I took over ownership of that in an all Bitcoin transaction in the first day of 2025. And so now, if you're interested in getting news from journalists that are fearless writing about important information when it matters most, go to activistpost.com and check it out. And I put 10 articles on there a day. And I think there's a little bit of something for everyone. Podcasts, crypto, empire, economy, health, solutions. We've always got solutions there. So check it out, activistpost.com, macroaggressions.io. Thanks for having me.
But listen, yeah, well, before you go, Charlie, I'm going to have a bit of a boxing match here with you, because I'm going to make the argument that my intro is the best.
Okay. All right.
We're going to have a face-off.
This is what I am here for. That's good. This is going to raise... We're going to raise both boats here. So my audience, I'm going to have my audience go check out your intro, and you have your audience check out my intro, and then we'll have a dance off or something.
Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thanks for having me.